time, and I can't remember how long he stayed over there, but he came back to Melbourne, eventually went to the Ballarat School of Mines, which was the only place where he'd get a mining education, and took his degree. Mark worked actually in the mines in Western Australia. I don't know for how long.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Over there for, I forget now, just a year or two. Then he came back to Melbourne. Mark went over to, Mark stayed over in the West for some time. He actually worked down in the mines. I forget how long he was over there. It's a bit hazy in my mind. Eventually he came back to Melbourne, went to the Ballarat School of Mines, which was the only place where he could get a degree of mining in those days. He got his degree and eventually went to the Tasmania Smelting Works in Zee in Tasmania, where he became assistant manager. Until his health gave way owing to the lead fumes, and he finally had to give up his profession altogether and come back into commercial life. I run into a bit of trouble here. I talked on the first side of this tape quite some little while before I realised that the first side had run out. I then had to enlist Jonathan's help. And he thinks he's put everything in order again, but I just can't remember how much I spoke that didn't record. And it's just possible I may be doubling my tracks, because I've got no way of finding out, except I run the tape back again, and I'm not quite sure how to do that. So risking going over the same ground twice, I'll carry on and say that we left by this steamer, the five of us, that is mother, father, Renee, myself, and our nurse, and we had a 6 weeks voyage to Southampton. The nurse who we'd taken to help with us children, as well as look after mother, who had not been at all well just prior to embarkation, proved pretty useless as far as the reason for taking her on board is concerned, because she went down with mal de mer a couple of hours after we got out of the port Phillip Heads, and practically never recovered from it till we reached Southampton. However, I was sent to school at Great Ealing School, which is just outside London, is really a suburb of London these days, and Irene was sent to a boarding school for girls down at Folkestone on the sea. I very, very well remember my first day at Great Ealing School, because we had school in the morning when I got there, and then lunch, and then some schooling in the afternoon, and then we all went out on the playing field. It was midsummer. For cricket. Well, of course, most English people and boys and all knew very little of Australia. The word Australia was mentioned. It was synonymous with cricket, because the famous test cricket teams have been coming to England for some 20 to 30 years, and the original teams, including the Demon bowler Spofforth and famous wicketkeeper Blackham, had made a name for Australia, among other men, of course. And actually, as I say, Australia and cricket, when Australia was mentioned, the only thing known was cricket. Well, we went out onto the field, and the captain or chap that was running the show that day threw the ball straight to me. Here, you have a bowl. And he, you know, the thought was, well, he comes from Australia, he must be a good cricketer. Well, great fear and trembling and trepidation, I took the bowl because I was not adept at all at the game. And walked up to the crease and took a little runner with my first bowl. To my great amazement, clean bowled the batsman, took his middle stump right out. There was a roar of approval around the ground, and I suppose they were saying, oh, they've got someone here, we've got a bloke here that we can put in our cricket team against the other schools. Anyway, the next five balls of the over were all either wide or no balls, and that was the end of me. So far as cricket was concerned, I was there for about a year. I used to come up quite often to see my parents, who stayed at a hotel called the Grand Central Hotel. To do that, I would take a horse bus from Ealing to Shepherd's Bush. Shepherd's Bush then was the terminus of the London Tube. And I'd take the tube to Baker Street. Get out at Baker Street, and I'd only have a very short walk to the Grand Central Hotel. All in all, I enjoyed my time at Great Ealing School, the Reverend Chapman was the head of it. He was a very jolly, nice sort of a fellow. His wife was a very motherly lady, and his daughters, grown-up daughters, were very good to me anyway, and I think to most of the boys. And all in all, it was quite an interesting period. I was there over the hot summer holidays when we were all taken down to Eastbourne, or not all, but the number of boys that didn't go home. There were boys from Egypt and there were boys from South Africa. I made very great friends with a boy called Cranko, C-R-A-N-K-O, and when I left to come home and he left to go back to South Africa, we used to correspond for quite some time, and in a rather childish, boyish way, we worked out a system of holographs, each one representing a different letter of the alphabet, and we used to write to each other on postcards, and these holographs, or whatever the right word is, this is a little incident that I happen to remember very forcibly. My Uncle Rudolph and Aunt Di, together with their two sons, Laurie and Athol, lived permanently in London and Europe, and we saw quite a bit of them. Laurie, who eventually turned practically 100% commo, was just the reverse when I was in England as a young lad. He was a student at Harrow School, and I remember seeing him in his Harrow rig out, and he was very much conservative-minded, and he became a major in the First World War, and went through most of it, and this completely turned his views on life, and he discarded all his background of Harrow and aristocracy and so forth, and became, just as I've said, just entirely the reverse. He spent quite a lot of his life in India and eventually died in that country. Well, we left England and went over to spend a few weeks on the continent. I remember Mother and Father taking us to Paris, and then by train down the Mediterranean. Then by train we went to Switzerland. I remember staying in Lucerne for about a week or two at a small pension called the Pension de la Villa Maria, and I have a very clear recollection of Lucerne in those days, with the famous lion carved of stone in the side of the wall, and many other things. I've been back to Lucerne on various occasions. I've always enjoyed going back there. Nan and I spent about 2 to 3 weeks there on one of our trips, and it's a town that always has great memories for me, and for which I have quite a nostalgia. We then rejoined our ship in Marseille and came back to Australia. Shortly after we reached Australia, it came up the matter of where I should be sent to school. Well, mother and father decided not to go back to East Melbourne, which was quite the high spot in the 70s, 80s and 90s. They decided to live in St Kilda, and they rented a very large mansion of a house on the Esplanade, St Kilda, called Queston, in the corner of the Esplanade and Robe Street. And on that account, they decided to send me to the Melbourne Grammar, where I only had to just step out of the front door onto a cable tram, which took me right to the Melbourne Grammar door. I may be a bit out of sequence here because I had a breakdown with the machine, and I spoke for quite a while and nothing came out on the tape. I'm not absolutely sure just where I finished off. I was talking about, I think, when I was sent to Melbourne Grammar. Well, I went there in 1902, about the middle of the year somewhere, or toward the early part of the year, very early part of the year. And I was there actually for 4 years, 1902, 1903, 1904, 1905. In 1903, I managed to win the Horn Prize, and which was quite a surprise to me. And I will remember when I came home, a week or so after that was announced, that as I got off the tram, I saw Mother standing in the gate on of our house at the Esplanade, waiting for me. And when I, as she and I walked up the front path to the house, she rather proudly produced a report from the school, which I remember in those days used to be posted to the parents at the end of every term. And amongst other things, it said his name was under consideration for the Witherby Scholarship. Well, I didn't get the Willoughby Scholarship, and I don't know how my name came under consideration, but anyway, it was quite a highlight. And I remember at home there was a good deal of complimentary things said to me about it. I always feel I was very fortunate. In my last year at the school, when I was doing my matric, that our English master, for some reason or other, was taken ill and not able to continue taking classes. And the headmaster, Mr. Blanche, we used to talk of him under the nickname of Gussie Blanche, he was quite an English chap, took us instead. Well, he was a very charming man, and he had a wonderful knowledge of English literature and English poetry and so on. And mostly found those subjects quite stuffy, under Mr. Blanche, I got an entirely different aspect and idea and lineup of literature, good English, and poetry and authors and so on. And that year seemed to alter the whole of my outlook from that point of view. It is remarkable what a difference it makes in the type of and personality of the teacher that a child manages to come under during their school career. When the matric examinations, which were held in the old Wilson Hall, were over, I remember how all the family said to me, "Well, how do you think you got on, and do you think you passed, and all that?" And knowing, as we all do, that have passed through these examinations, as we all have, one's doubts and fears and so on. And all I could say was, "Well, I'm certain of history. The other six or seven subjects, I forget how many now, I couldn't say. It's a toss-up one way or the other." When the results finally came out, I failed in history, but passed in all the others. A few days after the results were out, my father came to me and said, "Well now, Ernest, have you quite made up your mind that you want to go to the university and become a doctor? Because if so, I'll get the application form and you can we go ahead and enroll you." There was no trouble about quotas in those days. And, or on the contrary, if you'd sooner go into commerce, now's the time to make the decision. Let me know definitely which one is to be, and I'll arrange accordingly. After a slight pause and a thought, I said, "Well, I think I'll change my mind, Dad, and I will go into commerce." "All right, now, is that final? Have you made up your mind finally?" I said, "Yes, Dad, I have." He said, "All right." Well, he went away into town that day, and when he came home in the evening, he said, "You start on Monday morning with a wholesale firm in Flinders Lane called Gaylard and Greenwood. Your salary will be 5 shillings a week, and you're to report at 8:30 a.m. on Monday morning." Thus began my commercial career. It was during my very early teenage days, that my father became very much wrapped up in Masonic work. He was master of the lodge, which used to meet in the Freemasons Hall in Collins Street, where incidentally is the place where my elder sister Edith was married. And he threw himself with a great deal of energy and enthusiasm into Masonic work. In those days, a great feature was made of the entertainment in the South, and of course there was no TVs, there was no radios, there was nothing really in the way of entertainment outside of one's own activities, and among the entertainments by individuals by playing the piano or singing singing songs and so on, very popular method of entertainment was recitations or extracts from plays. My father was a very, very ardent Shakespearean scholar. In his very early days, he was attracted by the stage, and when he was in his late teens, he left Melbourne, managed to get on, somehow or other, I think, work his passage on a ship to San Francisco. When he got to San Francisco, he had to look around for a job to earn something, and the thing that attracted him most was the theatre, and he managed to get a job as a super on the boards in one of the San Francisco theatres. It was there, I think, that some of his enthusiasm for Shakespearean drama was bred in him. Anyway, be that as it may, in the period I'm speaking about, when he was very active in the Masonic world, he used to do his part in the South by reciting extracts from various Shakespearean plays. His most famous chef d'oeuvre was the address of Othello to the Senate. He used to get me to hear him not only his ritual out of the little black book, but also to hear him parts of the of these Shakespearean extracts which I referred to. I myself became quite interested in it, and I decided to learn some of these off by heart myself, and try and emulate his old-fashioned declamations and so on. I say old-fashioned because the method of a modern Othello doing the Othello's address to the Senate today, and the way Father used to do it, in the style of Keane and the famous great actors of the 1880s and so on, are two entirely different things. However, I learned it by rote, and I. That had copied from some of his star actors.
Just for the record, I feel that I'd like to place on this tape a reproduction of the Othello's address to the Senate.
Othello and Desdemona. I assure you that I'm reciting it from memory. I've got a Shakespearean book in front of me, and it goes as follows. Most potent, grave, and reverend seniors, me very noble and approved good masters, that I have ta'en away this old man's daughter, 'tis most true. True, I have married her. The very head and front of me offending hath this extent, no more. Rude am I in speech, and but little blessed with a set phrase of peace. For since these arms of mine had 7 years' pith, they have used their dearest actions in the tented field. And little of this great world can I speak, more than pertains to feats of broil and battle. Therefore, little will I grace macaws in speaking of myself. But by your gracious patience, I will a round and varnished tale deliver of my whole course of love, with what drugs, what charms, what mighty conjurations, for such proceedings I am charged with all, I won his daughter. Her father loved me, oft invited me, still questioned me the story of my life. I ran it through, e'en from me boyish days to the very hour when he bade me tell it, wherein I spake of most disastrous chances of being taken by the insolent foe and sold to slavery, of my redemption thence and portents in my travel's history. These things to hear would Desdemona seriously incline, but then the house affairs would draw her thence, which, ever as she could with haste dispatch, she'd come again and with a greedy ear devour up my discourse, which I observing took once a pliant hour to draw from her a prayer of earnest heart that I would all my pilgrimage dilate, whereof by parcels she had something heard, but not intentively. I did consent, and often to beguile her of her tears when I spake of some distressful stroke which my youth suffered. The story being done, she gave me for my pains a world of sighs. She swore 'twas strange, 'twas passing strange, 'twas pitiful, 'twas wonderful, wondrous pitiful. She thanked me, and told me if I'd a friend that loved her, that I should but teach him how to tell my story, and that would woo her. Upon this hint, my lords, I spake. Ah, here comes the lady. This only is the witchcraft I have used. Ah, here comes the lady. Let her answer it. There are a couple of other little, a few lines of Shakespeare that I remember. I think I'll just include them here as a matter of record. One, of course, was Henry IV in the Battle of Agincourt, when hears someone say, "Oh, that we had with us today 1/10,000 of those men who lie abed in England." And then the voice comes, "Who's he that wishes so? My cousin Westmoreland? Oh, no, my fair coz, wish not one man more. For he who fights with me upon this day, he is my brother, be he ne'er so vile. And he will stand a tiptoe when this day is named, and rouse him at the name of Crispian." Our father could recite whole lines of that particular play and go on at quite some length. And another one, which is a great favourite of his, was Julius Caesar. If I remember, "And when the noble Brutus saw him fall, ingratitude more strong than traitor's tears quite vanquished him. And in his mantle muffling up his cloak, which e'en at the base of Pompey's statue, great Caesar fell. Oh, what a fall was there, my countrymen." I won't clumber up this tape with any more of these more or less cliches of Shakespeare, which most school children know. But I just included these two extra ones on top of Othello's address to give the atmosphere of father and his love of Shakespeare and the dramatic atmosphere and aura of those days. Father was tremendously interested and immersed in drama and the theatre all his life, and used to, as when I was a very little boy, take me to the Theatre Royal to see the famous Plant Holt blood curdlers of the day, and I particularly remember, as a matter of interest to go on record, is when I was I suppose 8 or 9 years old, or a little, perhaps 10, my greatest treat was for father to take me on a Saturday night to Rickard's variety show at the Tivoli in Swanser Street. Incidentally, Leslie and I were passing there only a couple of days ago, and the famous old music hall is just about being leveled to the ground. In those days, the show consisted of a first half and a second half. In the first half, there was all the performers were seated in a circle on the stage, and the two men who were dressed up as dressed up with blackened faces were known as Pope and Sales, and they asked each other fatuous sort of questions and which were supposed to be most hilarious answers, repeating the question and the answer several times. And the others round the circle did various acts, sang, or they did trapeze acts, or they did funny clown jobs, and so on. After the halftime interval came the pièce de résistance, which was a showing for about half an hour of what was called the new bioscope pictures. This was the first type of movies ever shown publicly in the theatre, and depicted scenes of Switzerland, or looked down Regent Street of London, and of course they were all silent naturally, and there was no actual story. It was just moving pictures, bioscope moving pictures. That was the great draw. And I remember how entranced I used to be sitting there watching these moving animated pictures on the screen. I've only got a very short space left to finish this tape. I think perhaps if I could give some slight impression of my parents as I remember them as a little boy of 5 or 6 or possibly 7 years of age. Father in those days wore a beard and a rather heavy, droopy moustache. In latter years he shaved completely, and then in latter years again he grew the moustache. But he was rather thick-set man, and not very tall, it's about my height, possibly, yes, about my height, and a very vigorous sort of person, and I didn't know him in his heyday when he was right in the flush, I should say, of his business career. And when, as he once told me, I used to allow your mother £1,000 a year for pin money. In that remark to me many years later, in order to sort of convey to me that there was a time in which he'd